How hard do you think you'd have to work to become one of the world's great musicians, say Yo-Yo Ma or Nigel Kennedy? I admire both of them, but it's sport that I find really compelling. So let me put it another way. How much effort would you need to put in to become as good as Lionel Messi, the Argentinian superstar who, thank God, plays for Barcelona, but sadly isn't eligible for the Socceroos? What about someone who does play for Australia, Ricky Ponting, probably the most dominant cricketer in the world over the last 10 years, or Roger Federer, perhaps the best ever tennis player and someone who really is poetry in motion? How much work to get that good? By now you're probably thinking, Richard, you need another coffee. That's not work, that's talent. Yo-Yo Ma and Ricky Ponting and Roger Federer were all born with something special, a natural ability that just can't be taught. Well, the man you're about to meet might argue about that. Matthew Sides, a British sports journalist and former elite athlete himself. He's written Bounce, How Champions Are Made. And he's on the line now. Hello, Matthew.
Good. Hello. Nice to be here.
Now, I want to be clear. You're not saying that Roger Federer isn't talented, are you?
What I'm saying is that in order to become excellent in just about any field, and you're right to talk about music, the piano, sports, business, almost anything characterized by complexity, you need to clock up astronomical amounts of practice. And what I am saying is that when Roger Federer or Lionel Messi or Ricky Ponting started out, they didn't really have a great deal to characterize them as geniuses. That only emerged. They were converted from ordinary cricketer, tennis player, footballer into extraordinary in that field because of the transformational power of a very particular type of practice. And the cognitive psychological work that has taken place is pretty much all of us who are healthy have the ability to undergo that transformation to become excellent. Although I would acknowledge that in order to become the best of the best of the best probably requires something more than practice. But in order to get excellent, in order to exceed most of our expectations, we can all do that with practice.
But surely some attributes are largely about having the raw material. Like, if you think about sprinting, it wouldn't matter how much most of us practiced, we're never going to catch Usain Bolt.
Yeah, which is why I qualified what I said a little bit with the phrase, any task characterized by complexity, because in tasks which are characterized by perceptual complexity and what we might call motor complexity, highly complex physical movements, we're not born with those. Nobody is born with those kinds of attributes. They are built up through many, many years of practice. And you're right to say that in very simple things like running and lifting, or for example, Michael Phelps with a big wingspan in swimming, or somebody being tall to play basketball, you cannot change your basic body shape. You can't change your underlying anatomical configuration with practice. But what you can change is your perceptual awareness, your situational complexity, and the coordinative movements that create the brilliant timing which distinguishes Ponting from you or I.
Yes.
Ponting and Federer aren't better because they're taller, faster, or fitter. They're better because they have better anticipation and better coordination to create perfect timing. And those are things which are created through acquired mental representations.
But how much practice does it take to become, well, perhaps not one of the truly greats, but someone exceptional?
Well, it's interesting that when the scientists Herbert Simon and William Chase, one of them a Nobel Prize-winning economists, started looking at this, they all assumed that, of course, geniuses could shortcut this path to excellence. And what they found is corroborated ever since with the research that has been done on this, that you need around about 10 years. And Malcolm Gladwell, in his wonderful book Outliers, rightly calculates that most people find it difficult to practice more than 1,000 hours a year. So he says that 10,000 hours is a minimum requirement. And that is, if you think about it, an astronomical quantity of time.
It is. And the other thing that you make clear is that it's not just any old practice. In fact, it's 10 years of practicing what you can't quite do.
That's a brilliant way to summarize what the evidence is finding. We know through surveys of various jobs that some people can be involved in a particular job, a particular activity for many years without improving at all. And when analysis have been done of why improvement hasn't taken place, it's because people have worked or practiced within themselves. They've not extended their current limitations. we adapt, we change, we grow if we keep testing our limitations, if we keep just pushing ourselves to do that thing which is currently just outside our capability. The body adapts. The brain anatomy actually begins to change when it is put under severe strain. So, by the way, does our body. A lot of long-distance runners have big hearts, but they weren't born with them. It developed their aerobic capacity through and bigger lungs through pushing themselves beyond their existing limitations.
Actually, being prepared to do that, to always be trying something hard, that surely is a huge part of what makes a champion, because few people are prepared to go through it.
That's absolutely right. It's not comfortable. What Erickson calls deliberate practice, and I call purposeful practice, is not easy. And when I was playing sport as a teenager, I became the British number one, but I only started to accelerate in my development when I was prepared to ask myself questions every single day in training. Difficult questions, questions that my body found difficult answering. I was pushing myself in terms of my footwork patterns, in terms of my reading of spin, in terms of calibrating my own shots, in terms of its positional accuracy all the time. Tiger Woods treads the ball down into the sand to make the bunker shot fiendishly difficult. When top golfers find themselves in a difficult lie in the rough, they don't play one ball, they play multiple balls. And it's pushing yourself all the time that enables you to transform yourself into a top performer.
You were an elite table tennis player, but I was struck actually by something that you touch on when you're talking about doing something that's just too hard for you. And there's one ice skater, I think she's Japanese, and somebody has calculated that in the course of beginning her sport to becoming the Olympic champion, she fell over 20,000 times.
Yeah, this is a really vivid encapsulation of what the evidence is saying, that she was attempting jumps that were just outside her ability level. Implication, she fell down rather a lot, hard onto the cold ice. And in fact, a terrific study of ice skating was done by a Canadian sports scientist. And what was found is that elite skaters, when they're practicing, fall over more often than recreational skaters and sub-elite skaters. That's not because the elite skaters aren't as good. They're better. What it means is they're constantly pushing their higher ability levels against even higher targets. It's a very revelatory study.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Matthew Syed. He's a sports columnist and commentator in the UK, and he's also author of Bounce, How Champions Are Made. And we are talking about some of the things he discusses in that book, which I have found extraordinarily interesting. I'm intrigued by what all the practice actually gives you. You know about this from first-hand experience. How does it affect how you perceive things?
Yeah, this is very interesting because we often think of top performers, particularly in sports, as being faster, having been born with innate reactions that enabled them to adapt that bit faster than the rest of us. And I remember playing tennis with Michael Stich, the former Wimbledon champion from Germany, and he served at me at 134 miles an hour, and I hardly had rotated my neck by the time the ball had hit the curtains at the back. And of course, the inference that most people would make is, my goodness, how fast do you have to be a top tennis player? I wasn't allowed to draw that inference, because in table tennis, I can react to a smash kill in about 200 milliseconds. And yet it takes 400 milliseconds for a ball to reach me in tennis. And this essentially opened my eyes to what really is happening with top performers is they have more efficient anticipation. They are able to, what psychologists say, chunk. That's to say, with a single visual fixation, they're able to look at an opponent, look at their postural clues, at the pattern of movement, and predict in advance of the ball being hit where it's going to go. And it's that which distinguishes top performers from the rest of us. And that perceptual awareness only comes through practice. A top cricketer, for example, has figured out whether to play off the front or back for 100 milliseconds before the ball has even bowled.
Yes, whereas a donkey like me has to wait until I see where it's going.
Well, do you know what you would be doing? You and I, actually, because I went to Liverpool University and I actually underwent the experiment. They put some goggles on you so they can actually, sort of as it were, tell where you're looking. And when the ball was bowled, I was looking at the ball. I was looking in the wrong place. I wasn't looking at the movement of the body and the arm.
Well, yes, it's sort of counterintuitive in a way. Now, you point out that expert perception is something that isn't only seen in sport, and there's this great story of one particular firefighter who was able to save the life of his team because of it.
Well, exactly, because firefighters have got 10, 20 years' experience. They can look at a fire and comprehend its dynamics because their pattern recognition software, if you like, has been developed over many, many years. Whereas you and I would look at a fire and we would be drawn to the colour and height of the flames, they would see a dynamic, evolving scenario, and they would immediately be able to perceive how the situation is going to scope out. And this firefighter withdrew his men from the building moments before a floor caved in, and he was able to do that through long experience. And it's not just firefighters, it's clinicians, people making diagnoses from x-rays, all of those kinds of areas of expertise which require perceptual awareness. All of us have the ability to develop that awareness through time on the job.
The thing that struck me about the firefighter was that he just thought that this was a feeling. He didn't know how he knew that he had to get out of there.
Yeah, exactly. He cited, I think, a sixth sense. And the top table tennis player in the country, the fastest player, when I asked him how he was able to react in a blink of an eye, he said the same kind of thing. In actual fact, when you dig down into what's happening at a psychological level, as Gary Klein, a leading American psychologist, did, it had nothing to do with ESP and everything to do with extraordinary pattern recognition.
So what happens when you are an elite athlete and you start thinking too much about what you're doing?
Well, that's really such a nice question to follow on, because it's a phenomenon that we call in the UK choking. I don't know if that's the term that you use over there.
That's exactly the word we use, yes.
Well, and I've often been curious about this. And what is actually happening is the top performer is so anxious about what he or she is doing is that instead of just doing it automatically, they try and seize conscious control. The prefrontal cortex is activated inadvertently, and that's why they look like a beginner again. Spent years and years perfecting a skill, you've put it into the implicit system, and you wrestle it back to the explicit system because you're so worried about it, and that is the classic choke.
Yeah, and you know what that's like from first-hand experience, unfortunately.
I do. At the Olympic Games in 2000 in Sydney, I had a catastrophic failure against a very beatable German in a match that was live on British TV and meant the world to me, and I fell apart. And I think that's one of the reasons I was so keen to learn as much as I could about why it had happened.
I am never going to be an elite athlete, but I found something in the book very empowering. And look, I think it can be used everywhere, and that's the growth mindset, which comes from not praising talent, but encouraging effort.
Yeah, that I think is one of the most important findings. Carol Dweck, a Stanford professor of psychology, has done some pioneering work in this exact area. And what she found is, if you are somebody who believes that talent is what makes success, then as soon as you fail, you're going to interpret that as meaning you don't have enough talent, you're going to give up. If, on the other hand, you believe that success is about perseverance and effort, if you fail, you're going to see that as an opportunity to adapt and grow, and you're going to persevere. So what Dweck did is she took a group of students. Half of them were given a test. The other half were given the same test. And afterwards, she praised them. It was pretty easy problems they were given. Half were praised for their effort. Well done, you must have worked really hard. Some of them were praised for their ability, their talent. Wow, you must be really smart. She then gave them some very difficult puzzles to work on. The ones who had been praised for talent, they didn't want to lose that talent label. They didn't want to be losing their praise for being smart. And so they shied away from the challenge. They didn't want to take it. In fact, they regressed. Those who were praised for effort, on the other hand, they raised their game. They wanted to show just how hardworking they were. And the difference in results wasn't opened up by a difference in ability, but by a difference in mindset that had been encouraged by the way that Dweck had praised these students. And the implication is profound. You must praise students or anyone else for their effort, not for their talent. That's the way to embed the growth mindset.
I have to say, I have already tried to change how I speak to my children after reading that. I think it has very wide implications.
I think you're right. And I'll just leave you with this, is that Dweck said that the results of that experiment she did in different parts of the United States with different ethnic groups, and the results were always dramatic and always the same. And I think it's got a lot to teach us about how we teach our kids and our educational philosophy. And I'm thrilled you're using it with your children.
Yeah. Matthew, thank you very much for joining us today. It has been absolutely fascinating.
Thanks so much.
Matthew Sides, a sports columnist and commentator in the UK. He's author of Bounce, How Champions Are Made. It's published by HarperCollins, and I devoured it, I have to say. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National, and you're with Richard Addy.